Well, hello, and welcome to what is the 141st episode of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and him,
Scott Catanrelli.
How the hell are you, Scott?
I'm good. Well, yeah, I'm all right. How are you?
That was so resounding. That was so, and it was like, yeah, all right.
I just feel like we haven't spoken for eight. I know we because we normally text a couple of times a day, and this last couple of weeks, you've been so busy.
I have been busy.
That. I feel like I'm walking around going, ooh-ee-al, which is French for girl's owl. Yeah. In case you didn't know, because I know you don't speak French, do you? Dare I say it? I don't know if I even want to say this because it's just making my skin crawl thinking about it, but I've kind of missed you.
Scott, man.
Normally we're texting and we're not texting.
Oh, and I'm not. I haven't got anyone else.
No, no.
I'm not. There's not another in my life. It's still you. You're still the one.
Oh, and yeah, and I'm a bit bored at the minute, and I've had to cut back a little bit again, and you know, that's. Oh. Yeah.
Well, I've been in that London, and here's my segue. See what I do. Yeah. I've been in that London, which is where our guest this evening, who's sitting very, very patiently and quietly in the corner. I've been in that London this week, and it's been so hot. I've gone into full Northern. I literally just walk around going, bah, yuck, it's never been this warm in Northumberland. I don't know why I was speaking Yorkshire accent. I do. I've just been like outrageously, just like a blancmange everywhere. So it's great to get back up north and it's raining and it's 18 degrees. So it's beautiful.
Oh.
Yeah.
So we've not been too bad, but it's shorts weather, isn't it? Shorts with a jumper, that's me.
Yes, I even bought some smart shorts.
Oh, my days.
Yeah, very, very pleased with myself.
Do you know the best thing about working in your own office, in your own office where you are the boss, is you can wear whatever the frig you like, and I love that. Because I'm going in with my fashionable torn shorts on and, you know, my white ankle socks and whatever. Yeah, it's fabulous. Love it.
Oh, don't draw me on the rocks of ankle socks, because you know how I feel about socks. I've got very determined opinions about socks. I'm a man of a certain age.
No, it's not just ankle socks. It's fashion generally. Sorry, just let's, you know. Oh,
anyway. No, I'm not going to get drawn into this because I think we need an episode where we catch up on all of the things that's going on.
But yes,
this
is right.
Not this episode.
No, it's
people
not.
People have tuned in. We're in the top 20 podcasts of parenting podcasts in Britain today. So just, I thought you'd tell you that, top 20.
Oh, are we? Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, it must be a slow podcast week.
No, I would probably suggest it's because we had a minister on a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, let's not go there. We'll go into that further on in the podcast.
Let's go into that. Well, I'm going to end it very quietly in the virtual corner. We've got a rather smashing guest. We've got the wonderful Rob Leach, who is an adoptive parent and a head teacher. So it's always nice to get a head teacher on. Hello, Rob.
Hello, great to be here. I didn't want to interrupt the love-in that was taking place a minute ago, but it's lovely to be here. And thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome.
You are, it's lovely to have you. And the reason we got you on was because I saw something fizzing around in relation to a campaign or a petition, an online petition that you'd started through the you know, is it change.org? I can't remember now. It is change.org, isn't it?
So we've actually got our one on the parliamentary sort of petition website, but it's all linked to change, yeah.
Cool. And we'll get links, details to that. But before we start any of that, tell us about who you are and how you ended up being who you are now.
God, it's a big question. I'll try and summarize it for everyone so it doesn't go on for hours. I'm really lucky. I've got four incredible adopted children, along with my husband, Matt. And we adopted our kids sort of 4 or 5 years ago now. And it's been, as it is with any adopter, it's such an incredible, unique journey that you go on. And all of our kids are just so different. They've all got slightly different stories. They're all related. They're all birth siblings or half siblings. But they've all had such different stories in their lives. And since they've come to us and we've tried to muddle our way through as parents to these four, we've had to go down different pathways. And one of the pathways for one of our children has been to try and secure him the support that he needs in terms of his education with his additional needs that he has. And so to experience sort of firsthand as a parent what that's like to try and get the support for your child that you know they need, you can see they need, has been really quite revealing, particularly because, as you say, I am also in education as a teacher and a head teacher, and have seen it from a different sort of side of the table. To be on both sides of that table has been really quite revealing. And that's why we've wanted to try and draw attention to this campaign to try and make it easier and more straightforward for care experienced children to get the support they need.
You're like a walking soundbite, aren't you? You're just, you went from beginning to end in 3 minutes. You should be on the telly.
Was that good? Did you like that? Was that smooth?
Yeah, you've been on
training. You should stand for a prime minister or something.
Oh, well, if only there was a vacancy. Hey.
If only we needed someone to just step in right now who could speak. Crikey. Right. So you've told me loads of things there. First of all, adopting 4 children isn't normal. It's just not. But technically, you can't be approved for 4 children. Did you know that, Scott?
Yes, I did.
Oh. So tell us that.
That's news to me. We adopted 3 of our children. So when we went through the adoption process, completely naive, as you are.
Stop. Start at the beginning. None of this politician speak. Start at the beginning. Why did you decide to adopt?
Oh, we were just desperate to have kids. We really wanted to have family. And we really felt... we were both really lucky. We had great childhoods ourselves, and we just wanted to give a bit of that back, really, and enjoy it. So we started going through the process, and you go through the training, don't you? You go to the different sessions, etc. And you have a social worker. We were really lucky with a great social worker. And we were intrigued by the idea of siblings. We thought siblings could be really great for each other throughout their lives. So we were sort of looking at that very sort of typical 2 children, ideal, probably 1 boy, 1 girl, all of those things that you sort of picture. And our social worker sort of came to the house one day and gave us this profile, which had 3 children. We'd never considered going for 3 children at all from 0. We just read the profiles. We went through it with our social worker. And it's one of those things you just fall in love. You get hooked almost straight away.
Oh, yes.
And so we ended up, before you knew it, the whole thing accelerated. Suddenly we were there with 3 kids. Social worker, foster care is gone, thinking to ourselves, how on earth are we going to do this? And I remember that, I think we all do. We remember that first night when the kids are with you and you sort of panic every minute of the night that something's going to go terribly wrong. You don't sleep particularly. And then it was about 18 months after that, just as they were beginning to really settle and attach, that we had a phone call sort of out of the blue. And it was our social worker again who was calling to say they'd been, that the birth mother was pregnant again, and therefore coming to see whether or not we would be willing, able, interested in bringing that child to us. And we fought really hard about that because you've got to think about all the practicalities and the capacity, et cetera. But in the end, we felt we could. And so we were blessed when she came to us as well.
I mean, you've summarized really quickly, but that is quite a remarkable story, going from 4 to 0 to 4 in 18 months, 2 years, or however long. And I'm sort of intrigued. Were you both working full time prior to the children moving in, or because looking after 3 children is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And if there's 2 of you, it's still a lot of work.
Yeah, no, it is. We're really lucky. We've got a great support network. It was always, before we had kids, we always had both our, me and Matt, our parents both sort of lived 5-10 minutes away from our house. And it used to be a thing where we think, oh God, it's all too close. We want to get away. We want to move away at some point. And then we got the kids and we're like, actually, it's brilliant. We've got them on the doorstep. And I don't think we'd be able to do it without them. One of my sisters is really close as well. So we're really lucky in that we've got lots of people around us who really do help us practically as well as emotionally and all that sort of stuff as well. It was massive for us. We were both working full time before we adopted our first 3. And then I had a couple of weeks adoption leave when we adopted them, and then I went back to work. And my husband, Matt, he took a year of adoption leave, and then he went back to work, but he went back to work 3 days a week. And so he did that for a while. And then when we had the second sort of adoption of the fourth child, he then again took a year adoption leave. And he's more recently now gone back to work again 3 days a week. So sort of one and a half now between us.
Wow. So, I mean, you're still relatively new adopters. So there's still lots of change ahead, I guess. And so what was it like then bringing one more child into what was clearly a busy household that then... I always reflected, because we've got quite a few children. That's a strange way of describing it, isn't it? We've got more than is appropriate.
More than should be allowed.
What was that, Scott? What was that?
Yeah, you have.
And I was always really conscious that you reach this sort of critical mass where it is just, there's no way around it. It's just, it's 100% of you. You need everything. So what was it like, though, then, sort of a meeting the needs of this individual little person who was coming into a sort of a fairly settled family?
Yeah, it was really hard because it was the practicalities bit, but it was also for us, we'd got through the nappies and bottles and then suddenly we were back into nappies and bottles again. And sometimes you think, oh yeah, God, I missed that phase. It'd be great to go back to that phase. And then when you do go back to it, you think, oh my God, I can't wait until it's over again. I want to get rid of the nappies, I want to get rid of the bottles again, etc. It brought all the challenges and the teeth and all those sort of things that we've sort of forgotten. Because as time goes on, you remember the good and you sort of forget conveniently some of the more challenging bits. So for us, it sort of brought it all back. Of course, wouldn't change it for the world, but it's been challenging for sure. I remember being really nervous in a way that I wasn't the first time around, and maybe that's just experience makes you a bit more realistic about it, but I was much more apprehensive. I took a lot longer to sort of get my head around the idea of going again effectively. But again, when you do see them, it sounds really cheesy, when you do see them together now, you wouldn't want it any other way. You see the bond, you see the connection, you see the love between them. You think actually it's worth it, however challenging it is.
Oh, smashing!
So in terms of I'm just, because I've been looking forward to this one. Sometimes I just duck out of podcasts if it's boring guests and Al doesn't himself. I'm joking.
I don't do that.
I don't. I really don't.
I can't say that. But, oh no!
Education. I mean, in my, however long I've been a parent and then working in various areas of adoption fostering, education is probably the biggest issue for families that they experience. And probably, I would say, maybe adoption support may be on a kind of even par with that, but probably comes under in a little bit lower. So what was your experience of kind of special educational needs and the kind of families that you've effectively become and those with additional needs, not just our families, obviously.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think for a long time, you sort of, especially where, without sort of being a typical teacher, especially where you feel like there's not enough money, not enough funding, not enough people, not enough capacity in schools, and you're working in quite challenging circumstances sometimes. I think one of the things that always I sort of picked up on was, you'd have these sort of, I always used to call them like the warrior parents. And these were parents that would knock on the door and they would want a meeting straight away and they'd pick up the phone first and they'd email you any time of the day. And sometimes it felt like they were quite intense. And sometimes it's like, oh God, they're actually quite a bit aggressive. And actually, I've got a bit of an edge about dealing with them. And then when I went through the process of having a child that I was trying to get support for, I found myself becoming that very parent that was knocking on the door and picking up the phone and becoming that.
I know my rights.
Yeah, absolutely. You become that one. You want to be outside the school and be lobbying and knocking on the door, etc. And so you become that. And it is one of those things. It makes you appreciate a little bit more when you go through it yourself. But these are just parents trying to do their best job for their kids and trying to make their child stand out in a system where perhaps there isn't the capacity that's required to support all of them. And so you do have to try and shout the loudest. You do have to try and get your foot in the door. And it shouldn't be like that, but it is. And you end up becoming that.
And did you feel that you were treated as a parent or as a professional when you were doing that? Because that's, that's something that I know from my professional experience, And Al, I'm sure you're the same. You kind of go in and they see you as a parent rather than maybe you're qualified to actually talk about what it is that, you know, you're there to talk.
Do you know what? It was really interesting because sometimes when we were going into the school or we were talking to other agencies, me and Matt would talk about this sometimes. Sometimes it's just, we weren't just getting through to anyone. Mm-hmm. And it was always, Matt would always say, wait, just tell them you're a head teacher locally. And it sounded awful because it felt like you were playing this card that you shouldn't be playing because it shouldn't need that. But yeah, there were times when probably I made sure I signed off on an email with a certain job title. So just to try and make sure that actually we might get some they're hearing, or that people know that we know what we're talking about, in the hope that might advance it. And again, you feel a bit guilty for doing that because you shouldn't need to.
Yeah,
yeah, we absolutely did.
Mm. I would take full advantage.
Yeah, when it's your kid, you sort of you do whatever you can, can't you? And suddenly you can relate to everyone that's been in a similar position before. Yeah.
And in terms of your teaching experience, then, I mean, what you know, obviously you've talked about the parents, but what about children in the classroom? I mean, you know, without going into too much detail, obviously, because I wouldn't want to, you know, get you into trouble. But, you know, have you had that experience of, you know, kids chucking chairs and you having to get rid of them out of the classroom and all that sort of stuff? You know?
Yeah, I've always worked in schools that have quite high levels of students with additional needs, but also students with a range of behavioural and emotional challenges. I've always worked in contexts that I don't think are particularly well served by education in terms of policy very well at all. And certainly worked in a number of areas and communities that are quite deprived as well. And so I remember when I first became head teacher in a physical school, I remember my first day restraining three different children in three different instances and going home and thinking, whoa, this is a different context for me to be in. A great context, a context that needs people that are willing to work really hard on it. But certainly that's the case. And now I'm head teacher of an online school, and we have a significant proportion of our students, far higher than national average, who have additional educational needs as well, and actually find our provision a provision in which they can re-engage with their education without some of the barriers that they might face in physical school. So yeah, definitely as a teacher, being in and around students with a range of additional needs trying to support them with their own educational journey.
And in terms of, I'm really interested in this one because I have a child who has additional needs, but we don't live in the UK, so it's very different. But online school during COVID, he thrived. Is that something that, you know, the online, you might not have been there then, but is that something that has increased?
Yeah, I think that the pandemic, when it came to education, the pandemic sort of forced everyone to upskill suddenly into what it's like to learn online in a way that perhaps people wouldn't have been quite ready enough to take that step initially. Mm-hmm. So our school, I'm going to shamelessly plug it, my online schooling, we have 1,200 students across 80 countries around the world. And we go from Key Stage 2 all the way to Key Stage 5, so Year 3 to Year 13. We deliver the English National Curriculum and IGCSEs and A-levels and international A-levels. And you know, we have a whole range of students for different reasons across the world that come into our school. It might be that their families are expats. It might be that they're international sports stars, et cetera. It might be they live in regions of the world where there aren't good school systems, et cetera. But we also have about 50% of our pupils in the UK. And of those, there are a number of pupils who would have been school refusers in physical schools. They would have been students who experienced bullying. They might have anxiety or mental health challenges. And actually, when you think of particularly as you go into secondary schools, the noise in corridors, the lesson changeovers, the disruption, the bullying, the negative social interaction that you can have, actually providing high quality live teaching, but from the comfort of your own home, for a number of students with additional needs or have experienced some form of trauma in their lives, that's really comforting, and for their families as well. So the number of families we have who will say, you know, we never used to be able to get our child out the door. There used to be, you know, tears and fights every morning, etc. Now they can get this really good education. They're getting great grades, but they're doing it from the comfort of their own home. And then they've got the socialization with the friends and the hobbies they do outside of school that they love. Suddenly, you know, we wish we could have found this earlier. So yeah, it serves a real purpose for some. It wouldn't be right for everyone, but it serves a real purpose for some. And I think the pandemic has helped it become more mainstream as an option.
Yeah. Oh, wow. It's actually really good to know.
So you mentioned that in your wonderful summary of your entire life in 3 minutes at the beginning, you mentioned then your experience of seeking additional support for one of your children. Has that been the sort of the spark for you to then sort of raise this petition? So, I mean, I always wonder what makes someone sort of sitting at home watching telly go, I'm going to do a petition. So come on, tell us the story.
I know you sound slightly like someone that maybe is a little bit over the top or eccentric about something, but no, it was just that. It was the experience of trying to navigate the process. And I always thought to myself, I'm trying to navigate this process as someone who's in education. So actually I get the lingo and I get the acronyms and I get all of that sort of stuff. And I'm still finding it really hard. And if I'm finding it really hard, despite the fact I'm a head teacher in a school, then actually, how difficult is this going to be for some people to navigate if they're new to the education world, if they haven't gone through that system before? And for us, our son, for whom we were trying to get support for, as with so many children that have been in care at some point, had a number of needs that were through no fault of his own. He was badly neglected in his first couple of years. He had hypermobility difficulties. He was over 2 years behind on every age expected benchmark in terms of his academic progress. He had huge speech and language delay, which was largely from a lack of care and moving him off puree food onto solid food when he was younger, etc. And so you think to yourself, goodness me, there's this child who's been through the care system, who had actually been in four different foster homes and separated from his siblings during those before he came to us. Cool. And actually, when we first applied for an educational healthcare plan, the local authority refused to assess him. They said he didn't meet threshold. And I remember thinking to myself, well, if he doesn't meet threshold, then who will meet threshold? And actually, how can we get the support he needs in a timely way? Because again, as a head teacher, I used to see families that would lobby and petition and work really hard for their children and be rejected and rejected. And they might eventually get there when their child was 14 or 15 or 16, by which point they are so far behind, it's too late, frankly.
Yeah.
And so to try and do it with the urgency that's required is really important. And that's where care experienced children miss out, because often because of their experience in care, they are far more at risk of delayed identification of special educational needs, and therefore much further back before they actually get to the point of being assessed and then potentially granted extra support for an educational healthcare plan.
I mean, I pulled at that. That makes perfect sense. And obviously being a teacher, you'll have seen that firsthand. And I pulled up some stats off, I can't remember where it was now, but off Mr. Google. In 2019,
some random website.
Stats for podcasters website. for dummies. In 2019, 56% of children, of looked after children, had a special educational need, compared to about 15% of the general population and 46% of children in need. 27% of all looked after children have an education healthcare plan. Nearly 30% have SEN support. I'm just going through. I think the one stat which kind of shocked the heck out of me was in relation to that when parents sort of petitioned and appealed decisions, only 168 out of 4,800 were upheld, and they were overturned by tribunals, sendis to tribunals.
Yeah.
So in that context, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? Or is it?
I think it is. I think a lot of people would agree with the principle, which is the key test for any society is how it treats its most vulnerable people. And if you then follow that train of thought and you say, okay, well, care experienced children, however long they've been in care for, whatever the context of them going into care, if you follow that train of thought, you say, well, as you say, around half of them will have SEND compared to around 15% of their peers. When you look at it and say, well, okay, care experienced children are more likely to experience delayed identification. If you follow it through to the education side, you say, well, actually, less than half will achieve a 9 to 5 or A star to B in old money, English and maths, and are 5 times more likely to be suspended than their peers. If you follow that through, you say, well, actually, care experienced children are therefore vulnerable children and vulnerable people in society. You then add a layer, I think, which is the key premise here, which is, I believe all care experienced children have experienced trauma of some type, of some extent. If they have been in the care system for any reason, for any length of time, they have experienced some level of trauma. You look at the four main categories for special educational needs: they're cognition and learning, communication and language, physical and sensory needs, And the final one, social, emotional, and mental health. Well, if we're saying that children have been in the care system are likely to experience trauma, then they are likely to have some form of social, emotional, and mental health, let alone other parents' special educational needs. So for me, absolutely, they are far more likely to be at risk of having additional learning needs, and therefore we should do everything in our power to speed up the process for them to get that identification and or support if it's appropriate.
I sometimes, one of the barriers I've seen is, and we had this in relation to one of our children, was that my child was academic. And so when the conditions were perfect, they were able to do well. And so we sort of were lobbying quite hard to keep those conditions perfect, and an education healthcare plan would be that. And they said, but because she's academic, there's no need. And you're saying, but in every other aspect in school life, she's absolutely not. She's not doing very well at all. And ultimately, she did get one. But that was, like you say, it was a fight. It was in year 11, she got one.
I think you're right. And I think local authorities, and again, it's not a blame game here. I think local authorities would turn around and say they don't have the capacity or the funding to meet the need. But as a consequence of that, what it can feel like, I think, to families is that they're very quick to say no and to try and brush off and give an excuse as to why not. And you're right. You could be academically on point, but there are other areas of your development where actually you do have real difficulties. And within the legislation, within the law for granting an educational healthcare plan, those things matter just as much as the cognition and learning bit. So you can be academically on point, but there can be the social, emotional, mental health needs that can justify granting an educational healthcare plan. But how many families will be brushed off at that first inquiry and therefore feel like actually, okay, we can't get one and therefore we won't go back? It shouldn't be a case that the people who happen to know the most or can shout the loudest are the only ones that get the outcome they need. But that is unfortunately what happens.
Do you think that's in part because the school sort of make the application, don't they, normally? And so
if
you're right. Education, I mean, is their thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting because we actually applied for one as parents. We didn't go through the school. And it was, again, really typical. Especially during COVID, high staff absence from schools, high staff turnover in schools generally. We were trying to meet with a different Senko every other week when they sort of got appointed and newly appointed, etc. And local authorities would like applications to come through schools, but you can apply directly as a parent. And we did it because we felt like actually there's no one in the school who's stable enough or consistent enough in order to support us with this. So we're going to go it alone. Yeah. And again, that did always cause a little bit of reaction from the local authority, but you're perfectly entitled to do that if you feel like actually the school approach isn't going to work for you.
I mean, I think that reflected because a few people have talked about it on Twitter today, and one of the things I saw, I got this real sense of families exhausted by it. So that feels like for a lot of families, that's just not capacity. And then, but if we're thinking about looked after children, when we're not necessarily talking about children with champions. Social workers do their job, but this might be a battle they're just not able to take on.
I think it's really important. I mean, we use the term care experience children. It might be the foster carer really believes that they should have an educational advocate plan. It might be the social worker really believes they should. It might be their permanent adopted parents might do. And actually, it's about that idea. You shouldn't have to wait. Often what happens is that professionals think, oh, we'll wait until they are in placement. We'll wait until they've gone through the court system. We'll wait until they've got permanence. We'll wait for a period of attachment building. That's the priority. And suddenly you add up all of these months and years, and it gets to that problem that we said earlier. You're so far down the line that actually a lot of the challenges and barriers to education become so set by that point that it becomes even harder to retrieve through any support package later on. So again, if we're saying that because of the context of being in care, there's likelihood is that there'll be delayed identification of SEN and delayed application for an assessment for an educational healthcare plan, then we need to quicken that process. And that's why this campaign seeks to say that if you have been in care, if you're a care experienced child, then you should automatically have the right to be assessed, not necessarily to have an educational healthcare plan, but to be assessed. And we also use the phrase in the petition of upon request. Because again, we don't want everyone to feel like it's an obligation that if you've been in care, you have to have an assessment. It is upon request that there is a right, an automatic right to get to that assessment stage. because of the context that you've been through the care system, and therefore there's a heightened risk of your vulnerability.
So just because I want to clarify this, are you saying then that this can be at any point, that, you know, if there's a need in 4 years, even if they've had one like this year, that they can have another one in 4 years? I mean, just to be clear.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Absolutely. I think that it's upon request at any point during their education where you feel as if there are significant barriers to their progress and their well-being, and actually that some of that would have been contributed to by their time in care. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. I mean, this is something, actually, I have to admit that my dearest husband was cracking on about 10 years ago. And I was like, yeah, whatever. They'll never do it because they'll never be able to afford it. So I think that your petition, I mean, we don't have, because one of them is 23 now. He had a statement, and then that converted over to an HCP, and we went through all every year, you know, the same thing about getting it, the review. The head teacher saying, don't worry, he's not that bad. He just sounds bad on the bit of paper because we have to make him sound worse to keep the support and blah, blah, blah. And then actually going for an EHCP when they first came in for our youngest son when we lived there as well. But what effectively would this, because I'm looking at you, I've got the petition up here now, and it's on the Parliament website, and we will share the link to that. So far, you've got 3,067 signatures, and it runs for a good while as well. So that's a positive. But what do you see, and how do you see us trying to kind of help to get this up to 10? Well, it would be nice to see 100,000 signatures, but 10,000 signatures would be enough just to get them to kind of make start. And I think we're quite niche, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I drafted this, someone said to me, it's quite niche, and you'll be lucky to get sort of 500 signatures. That was the sort of initial target. So you can imagine when it first went live, I was sort of checking it every 5 minutes and just pick up one or two. We got 500, almost had a party. So I never thought it would get to 3,000 at all. But whilst it sounds niche because of the language and the acronyms, actually what this is saying is that any child that has been in the care system for any length of time should have the right to be assessed for additional support.
Yeah.
If we put it in blunt terms. And actually that, I think, becomes far more widely accessible. Actually, it lands better in terms of who this is for. And it's a wider audience. And so it sounds a little bit less niche, perhaps, if you take some of the acronyms out of it, for sure. And I think that, you know, for us, it's about trying to raise awareness. We also coincide this with the SEN the review that's ongoing at the moment. So the government's got a consultation out at the moment. It finishes or closes on the 22nd, so just over a week's time from when we're talking about this now. And so a lot of our people that have been supporting this campaign have been responding to that. We really want to try and influence policymakers. And as ever, when you try and do a campaign like this, people will say, the politicians won't sign up to it because cost. It's going to cost more. Yeah. I think the way we've tried to look at this is actually this would reduce some of the tribunal costs that local authorities face when people do appeal, and they can be quite significant for local authorities, which is ironically why some people, when they appeal, actually get their own way well before the tribunal case, because the local authorities will fold before they get to tribunal to avoid the cost of it, which is a ridiculous example of the sort of game nature of this application process sometimes. But also, when you look at the number of care experienced children who end up getting excluded and therefore have to get put in expensive placements that are alternative provision placements, when you look at some of the other, if you like, longer term costs, we believe that if you put the support in an earlier stage for care experienced children, and therefore they're likely to have more chance of overcoming the barriers in their education at an earlier point, that you will avoid a lot of the costs later on. And so it's really trying to get to the root cause of that rather than constantly focusing on the later term sort of symptoms that they emerge.
I mean, I think looking at online petitions, I think that in some ways as you say, it's got the potential to be niche, but I think it's a common sense petition that a lot of people who are not necessarily directly affected, but have a sort of connected, maybe less tangibly, will go, yeah, that makes sense. So I think it is, you can reach 10,000 Absolutely, sure you can.
I think so. I think actually, and you, I always think to myself, of all the people, because you get a lot of support from people that have experienced it themselves. You get a lot of support from people that have been through a similar sort of journey or battle or sometimes. I think to myself, they've signed it, which is great. If they all got one more person to sign it, suddenly we double our numbers. If they get two family members to sign it, suddenly we're almost there. So it is not necessarily just those that have experienced it, but those who have seen it in close family or friends that have gone through this process. And I think what you said earlier is absolutely right. It can be exhausting at the moment. And it can also be a postcode lottery. And I really mean that, because we looked at some figures, and these are just for applications for educational healthcare plan assessments generally. But depending on where you are in the country, in 2020, the latest figures were four, the variation between local authorities as to how many assessment applications are granted or rejected is enormous. So in some local authorities, 0% of applications for assessment are rejected. So everyone who applies get assessed. And in some local authorities, it's as much as 54% of applications get rejected. So it depends where you live. You could live in a local authority. It's the same law, but how it's interpreted by each local authority is very different. And so you could happen to live somewhere where that local authority thinks, you know what, we're going to assess everyone that applies. Or you could live somewhere where over half of the applications get rejected. And then you're expected to navigate an appeals process and a tribunal and all that sort of stuff. And that seems really unfair, particularly for those families with care experienced children.
Yeah, I mean, I think we did a little poll because we knew you were coming on, and it sort of generated a few questions and a few different perspectives as well. Because I think that, you know, we're, you know, people can probably predict what we think about things. We're not particularly, there's nothing very original in where we think. And so we did a little poll which said, you know, this is the petition. It's about getting an assessment for an EHCP plan for previously looked after children. And we were, I sort of in my head, I was thinking that he is, that this is a no-brainer. You know, there'd be no one who will go, oh, well, that doesn't make any sense. But actually we got, I think it's 84% in favour and the rest, power of maths, bit nervous, you're a teacher. 16% said no, that actually they didn't agree. And then you dig around a bit and a few people have said, well, one is I'm just exhausted from this, which was what you've reflected. Someone else said, actually, we're already in adoption. We have the, like in adoption, we have the right to be assessed for our children's needs. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. It's just, if it's a right to assessment, it could be just starting a fight. And another view that someone else said, and which has just escaped my mind, bear with me a second, I'll look at my little things. And people sort of saying, actually, that was the fighting for assessment, that actually they'd like, they'd prefer to opt out. But actually you've answered that. You've said very clearly, if you want it. So how do you answer those sort of criticisms where people go, actually, I don't think it is legitimate? Or have people reflected other, what have the naysayers said to you?
Yeah, I think that there are two main sort of naysayer ones that come back to me, and I understand them totally. One tends to be from people who've actually got an educational healthcare plan, and they come back and say, it's still really hard work. You know, they might have it on paper, but it doesn't happen in practice. And I think they're a bit sceptical that the petition perhaps promises a false hope that actually, yeah, this will really help you to have your child's needs assessed at an earlier point than they would do otherwise. And therefore, you know, it's all going to be okay. And of course, even when you've got an education healthcare plan, as we all know, it doesn't mean it's all right. And sometimes that provision isn't sufficient still. So it's not saying that this is the solution. It's just saying that this is reducing some of the delay and the lag in the time that you're likely to face if your child's been in care, and therefore speeding up the process to create a bit more of an equality of opportunity compared to everyone else that perhaps is going for it. But that's one reason that tends to come back. The other reason that tends to come back a little bit is people are worried about labelling their children. And sometimes they fear that some sort of automatic right to anything could end up in their child being labelled in a certain way. And I think there are two things on that. Number one, we've been really clear, it's upon request, not something that will be done to you, but an entitlement should you wish to use it. And I think that's a really important message to get across to families in this position. And the second one, of course, is that I can understand the apprehension and the concern that there might be from some families about even going down a process of being diagnosed with a special educational need. Certainly in the sort of online full-time but international school that I'm in, 50% of our students are international. We do have some students around the world and some regions that we serve around the world where we try and talk to parents and carers about special educational needs, and actually it's quite a taboo still. It can be in some places, in some communities, our children are fine. We don't want them to be, you know, considered to be in need of additional support, etc. They're fine as they are. So I think it's that there is still a little bit of a taboo and a labelling around it, as well as concern that it's something that would be done to you. I think what I'm trying to do is try and reassure people that it's neither of those two things.
Yeah. And it's interesting what you said there, because I feel that even though two of my children had EHCPs, it was almost, I wouldn't say a full-time job, but it was almost a job in itself to make sure that the school was, or the schools, should I say, were actually delivering on what was written into a legal document and agreed by the local authority. Because, I mean, an EHCP is written as such to be a legally binding document, isn't it? And to make sure that, you know, things like, in terms of strategies that were written into the thing, into the EHCP, to ensure that, you know, exclusion from a classroom or exclusion from school wouldn't happen. And if that sort of stuff started to happen, it was a job in itself to be able to go into the school and say, actually, within the EHCP, you have said you're going to do this to stop that happening, and that hasn't happened. But you can't then take them out of the class, kind of thing. So I guess it's damned hard work.
It is. I remember when we finally got the Education Healthcare Plan approved for our son, it almost felt like a celebration. It felt like, yes, we've done it, and we want to celebrate. We're really proud and we're really pleased. We're so, you know, grateful and we're really happy for him. And you're right, the first thing someone said to me was, this is just the start. This is not the end. And it dampened the party-like atmosphere slightly, but it was true. It is true. It is not in itself the end point, but it is something that hopefully will enable you to challenge and to champion and support. And yes, it can still be extremely bruising and difficult and time consuming, but at least it gives you a foothold. At least it gives you a position up the ladder that you didn't have before. Exactly. And that really is all we're asking for. Care experience children have a fair crack, a fair opportunity to get up that ladder to start with.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's laudable, and I can't see a downside to it really. I mean, of course, if you kind of put your cynical hat on, you can. So I think, you know, we'll add our limited weight to a bit behind the thing. But also I know things like the Adopt a Reference Group can raise that, which will push it up the agenda. People like the Fostering Network, why would they not foster talk? Yeah. So I think there's lots of people we can, you know, push that to. And I think getting 10,000 would be well within means and, create a bit of buzz around it. In fact, as we were talking, I've tweeted the new, the latest,
sort of, current,
who maybe wants to go and reflect on his profile picture on his Twitter page. Which so we've got a new. As we speak, by the time this goes out, who the hell knows what he's in charge? It could be Coco the Bleeding Clown at this rate. We have got James Cleverly is the Secretary of State for the Education Department. Will Quince, who we really liked, he's been put in charge of, he's actually been bumped up to a minister, and he's put in charge of standards for schools. Mm. So do you think so I'm interested, we're amateurs at this education business. Come on then, what's the word on the street down the water
down in the staff
the education
room.
World?
Do you know, it's total exasperation. If you change head teacher as often as we change Secretary of State for Education, the school would be in special measures, wouldn't it? It would be a real cause for concern. And I think
parallel works.
it's straightforward. People just want a bit of stability. We found it really frustrating because we were trying to lobby the team and the MPs and the Department for Education around this petition ahead of the deadline for the SEN review, etc. And we were having a couple of meetings that were being lined up, and then suddenly everyone was lying, it's all changed, new people, you know, they're going to have 110 emails a day coming into them, and you've got to try and build those relationships again. So yeah, when you're sort of campaigning for anything, it is really frustrating. Yeah. And it's really frustrating, I think, for schools, for teachers, for everyone else involved, because I have no doubt the people that are coming into the roles will be really well-intentioned, well-meaning. But as you are when you start any new job, it takes you a while to get up to speed. And in that period of time, yeah, everything else comes to a standstill.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Will Quince has retained the Send review in his portfolio, I believe.
Well, that's brilliant. What would be great is if you can help us reach Will Quince, because I know he was on recently and it was great. And we want to make sure that he is absolutely aware of this campaign and looks out for our response to the SEN review as well.
All right. Well, I do have him on speed dial. No,
good. Get him to join the call. That'd be fun.
Yeah, I'll send him a stern email.
I'm sure he's had a few of them lately.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels really like that work, the time, the energy you've invested in that it must be really frustrating as an educationalist.
Yeah, you just want to know who you're working with. You want to know that there's some degree of stability. I think people expect when there's like general elections, people expect there's going to be change maybe. But when you're only a couple of years in and you get this wholesale change, it just throws everything out again. It makes it harder, I think, for there to be a level of trust. And I think certainly people in education feel like there's someone else to get to know, you know, what are their priorities, what are their background, what are their beliefs, what are their values, et cetera, and to try and build those relationships again. Yeah, you feel like you're going back to the start of it all over.
Yeah. I think I'd agree with you. As podcasters who, you know, had a minister on and had a few false starts with previous ministers, shall we say, Al Coates's thumbs are going to be taken away from his keyboard the next time he has a bright idea like that, because actually, you know, it was a week after the podcast.
Oh. I tell you, it's the curse of the
the ministers.
Yeah, me and ministers. Every something bad happens to one of us. So this time, fortunately, it was Will. Mm. First name terms now.
Yeah, well, we did quite like him. He was relatable, and once he lost his politician mode, he was actually a nice guy.
We thrashed that out of him. But what was interesting, and I think we were going to talk about this last week, but we forgot, we got lots of feedback from people saying, oh, it really made me change my view of him. And then, you know, because he did warm up. But it's just, oh, man, really frustrating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, Rob, it's been fantastic to speak to you. And I have a feeling that we will be back in touch with you it'd be nice to know because inevitably we are going to get a government response. You are going to reach 10,000 signatures, and it'd be lovely to get you back on when they get that response and see what comes of it. And if we can add our shoulder to that wheel, that would be more than wonderful.
Thank you for supporting it and giving it a hearing as well, because it's sometimes difficult. There's so much going on and there's so many different campaigns or different priorities that different people have, particularly when it comes to care experienced children and adoption and fostering, et cetera, that to try and make sure you're respectful of everyone else, but you're trying to get your points across as well, it's really important. So this has been a great opportunity. It's been really nice to share it with you.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And having just signed it, can I just confirm as well, British citizens who do not live in the UK can also take part in it. So, you know, if you've got family and you live abroad, then you can do that as well.
I have a feeling, though, on the other side is that there'll be lots of people going, yeah, that's all well and good, but tell us about this school again that you're in charge of. How do we get our kids into this school? This guy, we like him. So, I mean, is it open to the general public?
Yeah, it is. Online schooling has come a long way in a really short period of time. And it's been really important to try and make sure it's accredited and quality assured, because anyone could technically set up an online school, couldn't they? You know, and it's got to make sure there's real safeguards in it. So we've recently been accredited as a Cambridge International School. It's called My Online Schooling. If you Google it, My Online Schooling will come up. It's one of the leading schools. Like I say, all types of students, all types of ages come into us. Yesterday, I was hosting or judging even our My Online Schooling's Got Talent contest, our end of year talent contest. Over 300 students submitted their talent videos, and we had a huge number of families sort of joining us on Zoom for it. It was great fun. And you saw all these kids around the world. One of the great things about it is that you can be in one of our classrooms. And I went into one the other day, It was a geography lesson. And the kids in there were really engaged. They were debating at a certain point that the teacher had put up. And there was a child, one of our students in Kenya, who was debating with one of our students that lived in Birmingham, one that lived in the Scottish borders, one that lived in France, one that lived in Spain. And that's their classroom. So the culture and the richness of it is just amazing. And we do have some benefits that physical schools can't offer. So we don't, we cap classes at 20. So it's always small class sizes. All the lessons are live, but they're also all recorded. So if you do miss a lesson or if you're revising for exams, you've got all of those lessons to go back on as well. There's no disruption. There's no bullying. There's no negative behaviour. So the progress you make in each lesson is greater. And therefore, the results tend to be higher. So for us, it's been a real journey, something we're really proud of. And we think actually to try and get that into the mainstream conversation that, yes, you can go to a physical school. But actually, there is online school as an option as well. Is really important for education more generally, particularly post-pandemic, when we've got more children than ever who are missing out on school. You know, you look at the attendance figures at the moment for schools, and they're still at record lows. I think 86% last week attendance was the average in schools. There's a huge number of children that are, for a whole host of reasons, whether it's mental health, anxiety, other reasons, just simply not able or comfortable to go into schools. And that shouldn't surprise us. Traditional schools, bricks and mortar schools, were built for the 19th century. And actually, that same model is pretty much there now.
Yeah.
Online schooling with the technology we've got, the experiences that we've got, is something that should at least be part of the menu of the sort of choice that the parents and families have.
You'd maybe think that, I mean, and I think, Scott, we've talked about this before, where we've seen that there was, it wasn't as clear cut as all children hated online school. A lot of children thrived. Some of the children that I work with, in fostering, some of those children got better results because the school went to online. It took away all this kind of this white noise from their lives, and they could concentrate. And you think, how difficult is it for something like the virtual school, because every local authority has a virtual school, for them to set up a really modest version of that for that slither of children who that is just going to work? It's the future, isn't it?
It is. I think we find it. You talk about, you often see headlines in the papers around sort of school staff retention crisis and all the school staff that want to go, and 40% of teachers are looking to quit within 5 years and stuff like that. And when we put a job advert out for a teacher, we get hundreds of applicants, and they're really good quality.
Because actually,
they want the work-life balance. They like the idea of working from home. They like the idea of not having to deal with disruptive behaviour or difficult behaviour. They like the idea of helping students who otherwise would be missing out on education, and therefore really being inclusive and making sure students that would otherwise be struggling making great progress. And so we have really, really high staff retention, really good relationships with families. And like I say, the biggest question that families give us is, what about the socialisation? That's the biggest question. And what's amazing for us is when we talk and give them examples, our students have online common rooms, there's extracurricular clubs, they're like chess clubs and stuff, they're just playing against people across the world. And they end up with this worldwide network of friends and peers that they take with them into their careers or whatever they do after school, that gives them a sort of global base of networks and people, and some of the exchanges and the holidays they do. But we also do a lot of physical activity. So we've got quite a few families in Dubai. So last month we did a big meetup, a picnic in the park for our Dubai families, and had about 40 families there. And so they then make their own groups. And for families and for young people that have got real hobbies and interests outside of their school, this gives them a bit more time to focus on those as well. So for the right type of student and families, it's an answer. It gives flexibility, it gives high quality, it gives good results, and it gives no disruption.
Yeah. So, and I'm thinking, the little adopter inside me is thinking, if you had a child with additional needs, what's the story with your attendance? You know, you've said that some of you've said the lessons are recorded. So, you know, if someone was having a particularly bad morning and, you know, it was all kicking off, could you just join later? There's no issue with that.
No, there's no issue with that. If we have anyone that doesn't attend, we do have, so all of our families, we call them success coordinators. So they all have someone in the school that's named person that looks after a certain number of families, and they get in touch with the family and just check to make sure that the child's okay, if they can have any more support. And if it's actually, do you know what, they just had a really bad day today, that's okay. Here's the recording, log on, have a look, complete the work, send it back to us. And that student can still make progress. It's not like they've missed that lesson forever, which is unfortunately what happens in physical schools.
Exactly.
Barrier going through the gate.
Yeah. I mean, part of me is thinking this is a fantastic idea. and I'm not challenging the idea of it, but as somebody who has a child with FASD and has this obsession with online stuff, whether that be YouTube is constantly on the telly or TikTok videos are getting played in my lug holes, I mean, is there a kind of a balancing in terms of, you know, how you help parents to support their child not being online all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we find is that students make more progress because there's no disruption. There's not that start of the lesson, end of the lesson, people walking in, people walking out, staff absence, all that sort of stuff. And therefore, actually, the progress they make more progress in shorter periods of time. So right. We help families to build a timetable. So they have a full-time timetable, but there are different options of when in the day to do those classes.
Right.
And therefore, actually, we fit it around the children and the families. But what we also do is make sure that if they've had a lesson, they then have a break off screen before they go into another lesson. So it's timetabled in a way that makes sure they're not just doing 6 hours back to back of off screen. Yes. That wouldn't be healthy or right. But actually, they don't need that amount of time because they make more progress in less time because of the lack of disruption.
Yeah, because I think that was one of the things within when schools were doing homeschooling, it was just from one lesson to the next. And if you weren't late, you were marked as absent. I mean, it was just like
traditional schools didn't know anything else. So they tried to replicate exactly what they do physically. Yeah. And that was never going to work. And that's why there is some degree of specialism in the online provision with schools that are full time online, that they can get that balance right. Yeah. We have classes. Some classes start at 4 a.m. for us if you choose that one, because we have different time zones around the world that of course we cater for as well. So we have some students that are joining us from the Middle East or Australia, etc. So we have different time zones. So again, we had a family the other day that I was talking to in Mexico, and they live in a wildlife park in Mexico, and their children are with us. And they do their school, and they sort of do their school in the evenings and the mornings because the middle of the day is really hot for them. And so actually they wouldn't want their children to be in a physical school for that period of time. There was a great example the other day. And again, it's a real range. There was a great example the other day where we had a family and the parents had decided to take their two kids around the world for a year to do like a trip around the world. So but they wanted them to keep doing a bit of education. So we had a young man who sort of logged into his science lesson, and he was at the base camp of Mount Everest. And after he finished his science lesson, he was going off to climb it. He was in the same classroom as other kids from all different contexts. It's really special. You wouldn't get that in a physical school.
Yeah, sounds fab.
Yeah.
I would have thrived at school like that.
Sounds like a right laugh. Rob, thank you so much for joining us. And as I said, we will no doubt get back to you. I've got my children are baying for me to do something with them, so I'm going to have to shoot off. Bless their little hearts. It involves
my kids are asleep. I think that's a false hope. Probably we're struggling with sleep at the moment. It's so hot, isn't it, that our kids are meant to be going to bed, and about 4 hours later they're still awake.
How old are you? I mean, I should have asked at the beginning. What are the ages of your children?
So we've got 11, yep. 7,
yep.
4, and 2. I'm really pleased I remember that, because otherwise I would have been in trouble when I got home.
11, 7, 4, 2.
I'm more worried you're going to be a grandparent before you finish being a parent as well. Oh, my days.
Yeah.
That's not funny, Scott.
I think it is. Sorry. Oh, sorry, Al. Did I?
Too soon.
Wow.
Excellent.
You're going to be at this for years.
I know. I didn't used to have grey hair, but it's coming through. It's flooding through now on my hair. I don't know if it's a teaching or the being a dad. Oh. One or the other.
Oh. You wouldn't believe I'm 27. Very hard to paper round. Right. Okay. Wonderful, Scott. Wonderful, Rob. Thank you so much for coming along. And I hope everything goes well. And we will be back in touch. That's fantastic. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
You going to say anything, Scott? Going to say goodbye? Can you be bothered?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I was texting my friend. No, I wasn't. I'm joking.
Bye, Scott. Bon Jovi.
And
Honestly, it's like working with a child.